Good morning.
I am Chris, and I am an alcoholic. Oh, if I throw up, please, there might be a story to tell everybody later. Holy cow, there's a lot of people in here. Thank you so much. It's an honor to be up here, tell my story, and I'm really going to focus a lot on after I came in. I would sit in these meetings when I came in. My sobriety date is August 16th, 2013. So a little over 9 years. And I would come into meetings like this and I just wanted to hear how you did it. You know, how do you stay sober for a day, for an hour, for a week? I couldn't relate to people who had years of sobriety, but people who had 3 months, I was in awe of. I couldn't believe it. So I would hang on to everything they said, and I would run around and ask people how they got sober. And, you know, so hopefully you can take one thing out of this today. Maybe it will help you today. And, again, if I throw up, please excuse me. Thanks for being here. My mom and dad are here. Very, very happy to see them here. I put them through a rough time. I put them through a lot of worry and a lot of stress, didn't realize it, you know, but they have been always there for me. And I have friends from 8111 that are here, grateful that everyone showed up here today. Again, my sobriety date is August 16, 2013. I was arrested with a loaded handgun and a suicide note. I was out of options in my head. I had didn't go to court a couple of days before that, and the judge said I couldn't see my kids for a year. I blew off the court date. I quit my job because I got caught drinking, so I was embarrassed. I actually turned my car in to Bank of America 2 weeks before. I called up and said, I'm driving drunk everywhere, and I'm going to kill somebody on the road. Can you take my car back? And they did. So I didn't have transportation, and I took a loaded handgun from a buddy's house, and I put it in a bag, and my thought was to go out and go get drunk all day and come back and do everybody a favor and move on with my life. That's where I was at. I could be in a room full of people like this and feel completely alone, completely helpless. I felt like I didn't have anything else in my life. I felt like I burned every bridge, I lost every opportunity, and I couldn't stop drinking. I would tell myself, don't drink till noon. And I'd get on the phone and I'd call some rehab places and they said, do you have insurance? And I said, no. And they said, well, I can't help you. So what do? I start drinking, you know? So I'm internally grateful for what AA has given me because I came into this program thinking y'all are taking something away from me. I was not court ordered to come here. When I got arrested, the police officer, Officer Hill, I was handcuffed to a bed at Kennestone, and he said, gave me a flyer on AA. I'd never been to a meeting, never even thought about coming to a meeting. I just thought I needed to quit drinking. And he said, we're going to get you into, you know, I call the rehab, it was detox, you know, was what it really was. You know, it's a fancy word for, you know, keep me safe for a little bit. And, they got me to detox, the Cobb Stabilization Unit. So anyway, I was born in New York, Yonkers, New York. My mom's Bronx, so she's 100% Irish. My dad's from Brooklyn, he's 100% Italian. So I didn't stand a chance out of the gate, right? I mean, I had all the food and all the, you know, the drinking in me. But no, my parents did not drink. There was not anything in my life in my early childhood that, you know, that I didn't see it. You know, it wasn't around me. I had the best childhood ever. We had a basketball court. We had above ground pool. We had dinner every night at 6 o'clock on point. My mom and dad both worked. My dad always did everything right the first time. He never ever, he did it right the first time all the time. I got my personality and my social economic skills from my mom. She would talk to everybody. We'd leave church, and my dad would say, go get the hook, because my mom would be outside for 45 minutes talking to everybody. But I had the best childhood ever. And I was class president my junior and senior year of high school. And, you know, we had 550 people in my graduating class. I started drinking when I was in ninth grade. Football games in the woods, you know, drink Southern Comfort, throw up, go home, you know, just kind of experimenting, nothing crazy. And, you know, I basically was a C-plus student, you know. I graduated, you know. I didn't really focus on school that much. I focused on sports, being social, having fun with people. I hung out with, we called them the heads back then. They were the smokers in the back, you know. And then I, you know, played sports, so I had all those friends. And I had just a lot of friends, you know. And one of the crazy things, we did donkey basketball to raise money, you know, and it was a complete disaster, you know. Great idea on paper, but, you know what donkeys will do, you know, and animals. So imagine that on a basketball court for 2 hours at a time. It was just everything we did, we raised money, everything was great. And I went off to college. I got into one school. My dad, we drove up, and I got into Clarion University in western Pennsylvania. It was 6 hours away. I lost my tie somehow in between. We went and bought a tie at this tie shop, and they basically brought me in on a probationary period and said, we're going to let you in, but it's going to be on probation based on grades. So I get up there, and, you know, I had a couple other friends from New York that went to college with me, and, you know, we I got a 2.0 my first year. You know, I got a 1.8 and a 2.2. So that first summer, I got a job. I can't remember if my dad got it or a friend of ours got it, but I was doing construction work, and I basically dug ditches for, you know, the whole entire summer. And, you know, I went back to school that sophomore year, and I focused on my studies because I wanted to get a degree, and I did. And I was able to graduate in 4 years on time, and it was a Christmas miracle. I'm telling you, it was just amazing. But what I did in college, I drank like everybody else. You know, I drank Ice House because I was in western Pennsylvania. So I had a lot of Pittsburgh fans and a lot of Philadelphia fans, and I became, you know, watching sports and Flyers, Phillies, you know, and all the craziness that was going on at sports up there. But I graduated in 4 years. I went one summer and took all the hard classes, the really hard classes, and, you know, economics and all that. And I would drink, you know, but mostly on weekends. I really was not a crazy, crazy drinker. And I had a girlfriend my whole entire college career, you know, and I broke up with her 3 days before I graduated college because she lived in Erie. And she wanted to stay up there, and I wanted to move to the South. And we parted ways 3 days before I graduated college, and I moved to Raleigh, North Carolina. My aunt lived there, and lived in Prestonwood, and, you know, it's a big golf community, and I got an apartment and started working. And that's where my drinking started to elevate a little bit. I was, I'd wear my suit to a bar, and I thought I was a $50,000 a year millionaire, you know. I had my credit cards, you know. So I would drink scotch, you know, when I was around, like, people I was trying to impress, and it was disgusting. I really was not a scotch man. And then I would drink beer later on, you know, because, you know, I couldn't afford scotch, you know. So I was all about the show, you know. Yeah, they say that analogy, you know, driving for show, putting for dough. I wanted to be in that social scene. And I moved, to Atlanta in, May of 1990. It was Labor Day weekend, in May of, Memorial Day. Yeah, so it was that weekend, and I moved to Atlanta, and they put me up in a hotel over, on Barfield. And I got there on a Sunday, and I had never been to Atlanta. And I started driving around, and I found American Pie. And for all you people who are in your, you know, late 40s, 50s, or 60s, you know what American Pie was. American Pie was, to me, an oasis away from anything I've ever seen in my life. Beautiful waitresses, a deck, music all everywhere, and it was just incredible. And I fell in love with American Pie. And I stayed there for about 4.5 years. There were many days where I would get there at 11:30, and I would have lunch, and then I'd have dinner, and then I would have a late night snack, and I would race my roommate home, driving home, you know, at Northridge, and just drive up Roslyn Road like a lunatic. I'd be there the whole entire day. And I really, honestly, you know, I was just doing what everybody else was doing, you know. I didn't have any fear of the police. I didn't have any fear of getting pulled over. I didn't have any of that. I just drank. And I literally did that for years. And never got a DUI. I never got in trouble with the police, never been arrested, you know, didn't get involved in any of that. I just drank and worked in sales. That's what I did. I was a sales rep. And you know, as the years went by, my roommate and I, we were, you know, we knew all the bartenders all around everywhere we went. And my life was good. I didn't have any big issues. I didn't really have a lot of hobbies, but I was out all the time, you know, going down the Chattahoochee. But drinking was always around. I drank, you know, every single weekend. But I was not drinking during the day yet. I wasn't doing any of that yet. And this program is a bunch of yets, you know, and the bottom line is that if I could go back and see that young kid, I could see where my life was going. So, I ended up a couple years later, I ended up getting a couple other sales jobs, and, I met my wife in, 1999, and she was a wilderness major. She went to Brevard College. She was somebody that I had never met. She was never anybody that she was just different, you know, and I liked different. And she was chill, and she wore Birkenstocks and, you know, a lot of hemp stuff and Burt's Bees wax, deodorant, and all these things. And I knew nothing about it. But she drank like I did. And that's another thing in my past. I mean, I always, you know, would be around people who drank like I did. So, we got married, and I'm getting really, cause I don't really want to talk about the sobriety piece of it, a lot of this here, but we got married, 3 days before 9/11 happened. And if that would ever give you any indication of how our marriage went, that was it right there. We were on our honeymoon. We're in Key West, Florida on a cruise, snorkeling, and they said, you gotta get back to your ship now. There's, you know, all this going on in the United States. And so what we did was we just drank. We stayed away from TVs and we just drank. And, you know, we got back to Atlanta. Everything is good. I got now I'm a sales manager at Nextel Communications. I got my manager's job. I got a team under me of 8 people. I have responsibilities, but I'm drinking a little bit more and more. So it started into more Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And then it started creeping into the Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Then all the events started happening. I got to go to this dinner and, you know, so you're drinking then and there. And, I got introduced to Crown Royal, which was another, you know, love of my life, you know, around that time. And I drank Crown Royal going forward. I realized I can get drunk quicker. It's a different kind of situation. Beer filled me up, so I would drink Crown Royal. So we bought a house, in Bridge Milk, you know, up the street, and I thought I had made it. I had a restaurant and a bar in my neighborhood. I didn't have to go outside the neighborhood. It was one of the biggest draws of why we moved there. It had a golf course, had a tennis court. It had everything. It was just a beautiful pool area. And we basically lived in this place that was self-contained, that allowed you to act the way you wanted to act, and there really wasn't a lot of judgment. And I liked that. So I worked in Norcross, but I lived all the way out here in Canton, but, you know, it was worth the drive. So we met a bunch of people, and at that, by 2003, we had my daughter, Emma, and, you know, I just fell in love with her. She was this precious little angel, and, you know, my ex had a C-section, and we got home from the hospital, and I had to take her back down to the hospital because, you know, she had jaundice when she was born, so we had to go back that next day, and I'm driving 45 miles per hour down 575, and I feel this sense of responsibility on me and this stress and this overload, and I was just so nervous to be a dad. But like everything else in my life, one sip of Crown Royal and all that went away. That was the crux of my story. And a couple of years later, we have my son, Charlie, you know, in 2005. And now my drinking is really starting to progress because now I have now two children. The night before Charlie was born, it was another scheduled C-section. I went to drop a couple phones off to a friend of mine in Buckhead. And, you know, I was just dropping phones off at four o'clock in the afternoon. And at 2 a.m, I was dropped off at my house in a cab, with, my dress shirt was ripped off. My cuffs stayed on, but my shirt was ripped off. I had an undershirt on, and my ex and her grandmother helped me up the driveway the night before my son was being born. Just going to go drop off some phones. And that is when, you know, I felt it in me. I had the uh-ohs, but, you know, the only thing that really helped me with that is I would just drink that away. So it didn't matter the situation, what I was in. The more stress, the more, you know, the bigger the event, the more I had to drink and kind of get all this out. So my son's born. Now we have two kids. And I am in this group of people with five other families, and we traveled around like a pack of wolves. We would go to Cancun and Jamaica and all these places, and we would drink, and it had to be kids clubs. So we could put the kids in there so we can go drink, you know, and everything was based around drinking. We joined tennis teams, and we joined tennis clubs, and it was all about drinking. So I mean, 2006, we were at Cowboys drinking, and we were all down, the whole group of us were down there, and we're all in the parking lot leaving at 1:30 in the morning, and we're deciding who's driving home. And I just said I wasn't driving home. I'm not driving home. I'm not doing it. My ex said she would drive home. But what do they do with Cowboys? There's always like four cops in the back of the parking lot, and they're sitting there watching. They're like, oh, these people are tagged. So my ex got pulled over and she got a DUI. Now I am screaming out the car because, you know, I don't want her, you know, I'm trying to control the situation, and I almost got arrested just because I was just out of control. But she got a DUI, but they gave her probation and she didn't even have to go see a probation officer. We paid the fine and it was like, that was it, you know? So there was really not a lot of deterrence in our drinking. I didn't really see a lot of consequences in my drinking. And so we kept on drinking, and it was really at a point then and there where I realized that I was stuck in three phases in my life. I was about 2007. I was either drunk, I was either hungover, or I wanted to drink. Those were the three phases in my life that I lived through. So in 2007 is when I realized that's when I became a daily drinker. I was still functioning. I was, you know, I'm a sales manager. I have a team of eight. We're doing great. We're making quota. We're getting awards. But I'm drinking on the way home from Norcross to Canton. I would I'd get a bottle or I'd have it with me. And I would drink on the way home because I didn't, my ex and I, the other piece of it is that we were definitely going down two different paths. That wilderness major, you know, who was, you know, all about peace, love, and happiness was now, like, I felt like she was turned into one of the Kardashians, you know, and we just were going down different paths. So I needed Crown Royal on the way home just to walk in the door. Because I didn't know what was waiting for me over there. You know, there was usually a bunch of people and, you know, girls over there in tennis skirts. They have, you know, they've been drinking red wine. There's pizza boxes. The kids are playing outside. And these resentments started to build up inside of me. I started to, you know, I'm working like a dog. And I just felt like I was being taken advantage of. So I would drink. I needed that drink before I walked into my house. And, you know, alcohol became my crutch. Everything based upon what I did was about alcohol. So coming into about 2010, we're still living in Bridgemill. We have our anniversary, our 10-year anniversary. And I played 36 holes of golf that day at Bridgemill on our 10-year anniversary. And I got her a card. I drove the golf cart. If you know where Bridgemill is, it's a CVS across the street. We were backed up on the third hole, so I drove across the street and I bought a card. And I went to Wells Fargo and got cash out and I stuffed it. I signed my name and I put it in there, and that was her anniversary present. That's where I was at. Selfishness, self-centeredness, you know, that's who I was. But is my life unmanageable? You know, my team is doing great. We're number one in the Southeast. I'm making great money. We're living in Bridgemill. I haven't had a DUI, you know, so I drink a little bit more than other people, you know. A good friend of mine, Craig Sager, lived in Bridgemill, and he was one of my tennis golf partners, and we would have so much fun together, and I coached his son in basketball, and he always would tell me about how you got to live life to the fullest, you know, and he did. He traveled around, and he's the NBA guy, and he's interviewing all these people. I thought, you know, I'd go in his basement and see he had Shaquille O'Neal sneakers and all these signed things. And, you know, my motto is live life to the fullest. Everything's going to work out, you know, no repercussions. But here come the yes, you know, now they're starting to come out. So my ex and I decided that we were going to get a divorce. And this was in, before it happened, at Sprint Nextel, you know, corporate America, it's hire 10, fire 15, hire 12, you know, fire 11. So I had to let go of 16 people on a Friday. We went through a reorg. A lot of them were admins. I had to let go of a sales manager and sales reps. So I drank like I remember drinking the night before. And I that was the first time I drank on the way to work that I can remember. I'm sure there was other times, but I drank on the way to work because I had to go tell all these people that they're losing their job. And, you know, there were packages that everybody would get, and I did a lot of them over the phone because there were some remote offices. And I remember one of the husbands called me up, the admin from Augusta, and he said, "You've just ruined our life." He called me on my phone, and it weighed so heavy on me. And I drank. I couldn't wait to get done with the day because I had to go drink and clear my head. And once I had that first drink, it just washed it all away. Because my self-centeredness and everything that I went through in my life, you know, that first drink took everything away. If I had Crown Royal close to me, I felt better about life. I had to have it around me. So I drank that whole entire weekend, and knowing that what I did to these families, you know, and I had to make tough decisions. And I came in on Monday, and my boss called me in the office and said my job was being eliminated. So I was like, thank God, get me out of here. This place is crazy. And they gave me a package that was like 10 months salary and all this stuff. And so I said, this is perfect. You know, now I can go drink like I want to go drink. And I did. I hit about 4 mailboxes in the span of about 3 weeks, in Bridge Mill. I blew out my tire on a couple of curbs, after swimming in my friend's pool late at night. I'm drinking and driving everywhere, but I'm not leaving my neighborhood, you know. Roger Garrison was a sheriff at the time. He was on our tennis team, and so I felt so insulated about that I wasn't going to get in trouble. But trouble was about to find me. So then my ex and I decided to get divorced. Wow, I lost my job, you know, now you're going to get divorced, you know. I was like, how ironic. And I said, fine, take everything. All I want is my TV and you can have my clothes. Take everything, and I agreed to a settlement. We did a non-contested, and then we got divorced. And we decided to stay in the house together for 5 months while we tried to sell it, which I do not recommend to anybody in any way, shape, or form. It was an absolute disaster. I would go out on a Saturday. She would go out Sunday. I would go out Monday. She'd go out Tuesday. And it was just constant craziness. And I would wake up in the morning and I'd look at my phone and see the text messages that I sent. The things that I was getting, all these things out, they were pent up in me. All the resentments that I had, that I felt like I was paying for all these things in the family. I was just resentful toward her. And I took it out on her tremendously in words and things like that. So I was spending money then, and I missed a child support payment. And somehow she got an investigator to find out where I was spending my money and where I was going through my phone records and things like that. And she took me to court because she saw that I was spending money and not paying child support. And then she put a protective order on me that she didn't want me to see or talk to the kids until we went to this court date. Didn't touch her, didn't threaten her, didn't do any of that, but my actions and what I was doing, you know, she had every right. And they served me with the paperwork, and of course I called her in a drunken stupor and I apologized to her for my drinking. I just want to say I'm sorry, I know I'm out of control right now. And that's when she called the police and said I contacted her, and they said, you know, I had a warrant out for my arrest. I violated my protective order. And I didn't go to court. I didn't go to court, and the judge said, you can't see your kids for a year. So that was the week before I ended up getting arrested. And that's when I called Bank of America and said, come get my car. I can't do this anymore. I'm going to kill somebody. I then was working for Racetrack Corporate, and my boss caught me drinking on a Friday, and I went in on Saturday and resigned. Just resigned. Left all my computer, my badge, and just resigned because I was too embarrassed that I drank and I got caught. And I quit my job. So now I have no job, no car, no money, and I'm just kind of floating around Atlanta, and I thought my life was over. And I skipped a lot of steps in there because of time, but I literally was so desperate to find any type of connection with anybody and felt lonely in a room full of people that it was just a horrible experience. So I felt like I just needed to end everything. And then I get arrested and they take me to Cobb Stabilization Unit. And in there, a guy came in and did a meeting, and he ended up being my sponsor. His name is John. And he told his story, and he went did an AA meeting, and I begged him to be my sponsor when he was leaving. And he said three things. If I'm going to be your sponsor, if you lie to me, you're out. If I ask you to do something, an assignment, and you don't do it, you're out. And if you got what I got, you got a thinking problem, not a drinking problem. And he goes, call me when you get out of detox. And I did. I called him when I got out of detox. So I walked out of detox. They're like, 8 or 9 days. I'm high-fiving everybody, hugging everybody. And I walk out and Cobb County Police is waiting for me to deal with that gun charge. You know, I was like, thought they forgot about me. My parents had to go get a bond for me. We were joking how James Bond bonding service were the nicest people to my poor parents who had to go deal with their son who's now in detox. And I got bonded out and I came up here to the Howe place and a 6 o'clock meeting on a Friday was my first meeting. And the first person I met was Stumpy. And a lot of y'all might remember Stumpy. Yeah. Stumpy would drive his motorcycle with an oxygen tank, you know. I mean, he was, his passenger door didn't open, but he was here. And he said two things to me. He said, if you remember anything about this meeting, remember the first line of how it works? Rarely have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly followed our path. And the second thing he said to me is, don't quit before the miracle happens. And he walked in that door, and I came in here, and I started listening to all of you, what you shared. And how you shared. And I was like, there's no way these people are going to get me sober. I'm too far gone. And my sponsor bought me this big book right here out of that cabinet in the back. And he said, we're going to start doing step work tomorrow. I want you to read this and here's your assignment and I'll see you in the morning. And he came over to my parents' house. We went down in the basement. My dad made stuffed shells or chicken parmesan. I can't remember what he made. It was fantastic. We didn't know what was going on. We spent 4 hours outlining the big book and talking about this. And he says, until you concede your innermost self that you are the problem and none of anybody's, any of these other people in your life are the problem, if you don't concede to that, then this is not going to work. If you are not 100% honest with me about what's going on, this is not going to work. If you don't realize there's a God of your understanding who can get you sober because you tried and you can't do it, if you don't figure that out, this is not going to work. And I said, I will do whatever you want me to do. And I had the greatest boss in the world. His name is Mike Lowry. He says, you hire based on willingness and ability. We can teach people the ability piece. We can teach you how to use a cell phone or a Nextel phone or a sales rep how to use Salesforce, but I can't teach willingness. I can't get people out of bed in the morning. You got to have that within you, and I had the willingness. If he would have asked me to hold a sign up on 575 and said, I'm a drunk, I would have done it. I would have done anything he asked me to do. And we get done with that 4 hours on that Saturday, and we thought we had to write him a check. I'm like, how much do we owe you, you know? And he's like, no, this is for me more than it is for you. I'll see you tomorrow. And he left. And we looked around. We didn't know what was going on. And I came back on Sunday, and I came to this meeting, and I met him on Sunday. And I met him on Tuesday, and I met him on Friday. And then he would call me up and say, I'll be there 10 o'clock in the morning, and I would be with him all day till 9 o'clock at night, going to Cartersville and other meetings. And I started understanding that people were just like me. I wasn't alone. That this program is not about taking anything away from me. It is freely giving me a gift that I need to accept and understand that this is a gift. Sobriety is a gift. I am so grateful to be an alcoholic. I'm grateful that I'm in these rooms because these principles that are up on the wall here are exactly how God wants us to live life. But I was not honest. I had zero hope. I didn't have any integrity. I thought I did, but I didn't. I wanted to do something for you, but I wanted you to do something for me my whole entire life. And I started getting this program, and it was great. And I'm sponsoring people. And then my sponsor says, you're going to go do the meeting that I met you in at that detox unit. And I walked in there, and I did that for a year and a half. Every Wednesday, I'd go down there, and I would do a beginner's meeting for the people in detox. And I would say, I was in that room right there 10 months ago, and now I haven't had a drink in 10 months, and I was amazed. And, you know, everything my sponsor did, he saved my life. And he was hard on me, but I needed that. Kimber gave me my first job. We painted a deck at Lake Allatoona, you know. People gave me rides. People would just share their experience with me, and it made me feel like, okay, I'm not alone. But the biggest, you know, gift that I got was that I am not at a place in my life where I could sit here and freely say that I can make decisions without God in my life, because I have proven that I will mess things up. I was actually watching a show the other day. Tim and I are big movie buffs, and I was watching a show, and the show is The Firm. It's a 22-episode thriller series on Amazon that Mitch McDear and Abby McDear from the movie. It's fantastic. And the very last scene of that show, there's a sign on the wall, and it says, I gotta get my other glasses because I'm 55. It says, to be yourself in a world that is constantly trying to make you something else is the greatest accomplishment. To be in a world that is constantly trying to make you into something else is the greatest accomplishment. And it really spoke to me. And then Abby McDear, in the last scene, she said, if something out there is trying to prevent you from being who you truly are, fight it. And it was a quote from this guy who I didn't know who he was. His name was Ralph Waldo Emerson. Yeah. So I look up, I go, who's this guy? And I'm like, why do I like this quote so much? Well, he's the first, and Emerson wrote essays. His most popular essay was called Self-Reliance, in which the writer instructs his listener to examine his relationship with nature and God and to trust his own judgment above others. Of course I love it, because I spent so much of my life trusting my own judgments, and it landed my ass in a seat in these rooms. It's the crust of who I am. I tried to do things my own way, the way I wanted to do them. I did them all with that fact of, if I had alcohol in me, I could do anything. I was Clark Kent going in the phone booth, two crown and diets, and I was Superman. I could do anything in this world. And I leaned on that for my life, you know, most of my life. So when you come in these rooms, what's going to fill that void? What's going to give you that feeling? Well, the feeling is the AA army in here, that you have all lived that life and you know exactly that feeling that I'm describing. So everything is going great in my life. I'm a year and 8 months sober, and I go to the doctor. I got a lump under my armpit, and I have male breast cancer. And it rocked me. And my best friend, Karen, saved my life. You know, she took me to 65 radiations, 30-something, you know, chemos, 9-10 surgeries. I was a mess for 5-plus years. And you know who called me and checked on me? Were people in these rooms. You think my drinking buddies called and checked on me? Were there for me? Hell no, they weren't there for me, but y'all were. I had people doing meetings with me over my phone. They would put the phone on and I would listen to meetings because I was in the hospital for 6 weeks. I have scars, I had ports, I had kink. I had all kinds of things going on. And Karen, she's my best friend. I put so much undue pressure on her because I couldn't do it alone. Because in life we can't do things alone. We need help. We got to recognize what we're doing to the people we love. And I shared when I got my chip that my parents, my first week of sobriety, someone called them and said I was drinking a beer walking down Bell's Ferry. And my parents raced out of Deer Run and were in the back of the parking lot, you know, upset. And they're like, someone called and said, you're drinking a beer. I thought you were going to do this thing. I go, no, it was an energy drink. I'm not drinking a beer. And that's when I realized what I was doing to other people in my life. Alcoholism is not about what you're doing to yourself. It's what you're doing to the people closest to you and your loved ones. All these realizations in this room have made me realize that I led a selfish, dishonest life. And I had to get all that out. So what I will tell you, and looks like time is close to being up. I've been sober for a little over 9 years. I don't know how the hell I did it, other than the fact that I still do this program one day at a time. I don't try to, my sponsor would say, you're a grain of sand on a beach. Stop trying to boil the ocean. You are who you are. Your job right now is to clean house, trust God, and help others. Right. That's our goal. That's what we have to do. And that's what I live to try to do every single day of my life. I have had 3 sponsees make it through all 12 steps who are still sober today. I've had over 60 that are not. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. If you are new in this program, go buy a big book. Get a big book for $20. Get a sponsor. Day one. Start doing step work immediately. Get involved. They had me as a greeter in the Monday night meetings. I would mop and sweep the room in here. I'd put all the chairs on the table between the brown baggers and the 6 o'clock meeting because this was the only place I felt safe at. I would sit right where Ken is sitting. I'd stare right at that clock, and I was grateful I made it another hour. And that's where I was in the beginning of my program. I go to meetings 5 or 6 times a week still today. I have friends in this program that I know I can lean on, my friends from 8111, all of you people here at the Howe Place. My first meeting at 8111, when I got sick and all my doctors were at Northside Atlanta, I left here and moved down there, and I met Grant. He's back there, and he showed me around 8111. I actually drove around the clubhouse like 4 times, nervous to go in. You know, I had like 3 years sobriety, whatever, and I was 4 years, and I was nervous to walk in. But it doesn't matter what clubhouse you go in. It doesn't matter when we read the promises. It doesn't matter when we do the chips. The meeting's the same. You have to trust God because we have proven that we can't do it on ourselves. You have to help others in this program because if you don't give this gift freely away to somebody else and you hold it to yourself, you're doing yourself and someone else a disservice. And you have to realize that every single day, I do step 10 every day because I make mistakes every single day. I don't live these promises right every day. And I have to make amends and tell people, hey, I didn't do that right. And I have to be conscious of where I'm at in my life. I can't believe that I got sober during football season. And I say that every single year. I got sober the first day of college football. Go Dogs, by the way. I got my rent. But I can tell you that it was the hardest thing I've ever had to do. Until I came and realized that you weren't taking anything away from me, you were giving me a gift. This program saved my life. I can't thank you all each and every day enough for what you share every day because I relive the meeting all day long as I go through your shares. Whether you have 10 days or whether you have 18 years, it doesn't matter to me. You've gone a day without drinking alcohol. And once you get through and you make your amends, you find out the why, which is step 4 and 5. People hit the brakes on 4 or 5. 4 or 5 is the reason why we drink. And that's the why steps. And that's what I found out because I lived in fear 24/7 of not being good enough, not living up to expectations, and not having enough in the tank to get the job done. And I felt I needed Crown Royal to do that. Well, we don't. So when I read something like Ralph David, you know, Waldo Emerson says, when I read what he wrote, why I liked it so much is because it's talking about self-reliance. And it reminded me that I live more of my life at 55 years old trying to do it my way and less of my life trying to do it in God's way. So I still have work to do in this program. My sponsor had me read the very first day where men and women who have recovered from alcoholism doesn't mean we graduate from this program. It means the obsession's been lifted. I hope everybody has a great day. God bless all of you, and thanks for letting me tell my story.